This is Newsroom, a production of the Radio TV Film Department at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I'm Michael Hiplin. On today's program, I'll be joined by three members of the Arkansas chapter of Vietnam Veterans of America. We'll discuss recent efforts to normalize relations with Vietnam, efforts to deal with the problem of homeless vets, and the release of a new POW MIA stamp. That's on the way in the next half hour on Newsroom. My guests are Jim Stanley. He's the current State Council Executive President and the attorney representing the Arkansas chapter. Paul Howell, former State President and now current chaplain for the group. And Wayne Knowles, State Council Vice President and President of the Pulaski County Chapter of Vietnam Veterans. I'd like to start with a story that's been in the news this past week, where top-level government officials are recommending that President Clinton allow the U.S. to establish formal diplomatic relations with Vietnam, saying that that would encourage further cooperation from Vietnam on efforts to determine the fate of soldiers listed as missing in action. Now, your group has been opposed to the normalization of relations all along. What would you like to see before any further normalization is done?
There's a 2,103, I believe. Is that correct, Wayne? Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the vicinity of that. At least we know there's 23 Arkansans is still missing. Out of the 23, we know through the Veterans Task Force of POWMI Affairs, there are seven discrepancy cases. Discrepancy cases are those that were last seen. A POW was seen in a POW camp. They were actually seen alive. But if, in fact, they were seen alive in a POW camp, why can they not turn their remains back to us? They're not doing it. They haven't done it. And there's seven cases out of the 23. So this is what concerns us.
Harold Bennett.
And, yeah, well, Wayne, you go ahead
Harold,
and say that.
Harold Bennett, or Harold George Bennett, is an example. He was executed on public radio. The guy who did the execution is one of the people we're negotiating with. But Vietnam says that they have no knowledge of his remains.
So that's a bona fide discrepancy case. Jim, you want to elaborate on that?
You have to remember that this country tore its heart and soul out over Vietnam. Almost 60,000 Americans died in Vietnam. Over 300,000 were wounded. And probably an even greater number came back with physical or emotional scars. More veterans have died from suicides from Vietnam. They were actually lost in combat or an accident in country. And it's just concerned a lot of us that I think we're rushing to judgment too quick on this. The United States, other than its cooperation on the POW-MIA issue, needs absolutely nothing from the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. Nothing. There's nothing that country can give our country that we need at all. It's not critical, like, say, Kuwait was, for example, or our interest in Europe or in Mexico or the Caribbean. So then I think we need to ask ourselves, what are we going to get by having improved relations with Vietnam? Now, it's not the Vietnamese people we have any problem with. As Paul correctly said, veterans are working with veterans over there that once were opposing each other at fire bases and whatnot. And we understand each other over there. And I think probably the Vietnamese people we have a relationship with, and I think the U.S. Sympathizes with them and realizes they've been under a tyranny for a long time. But you got to understand that the government we're dealing with here even though it may appear on the surface of it to want foreign capital and want to go to a market-based economy, is still basically a ruthless, one-party, totalitarian tyranny. And that has not changed, essentially. You know, sure, you go into Saigon and or Ho Chi Minh City, as they call it now, and the first appearance on there is that, capitalism is thriving. And indeed, it probably is. But you got to remember, what don't they have? Do they have full freedom of religion? Of course not. Catholics have been suppressed over there for a long time. Do they have the right to form a minority or opposition parties? No. There's the freedom that we take for granted, or even the freedoms that the South Vietnamese government had for all its problems, have been suppressed by this government for so long that I think there's a real question as to whether or not our country needs to be developing full relations. And I'm talking now about recognition of the governments and accounting for all the finances. And remember, there's a lot of money both sides are claiming each other owes, both officially and privately. And all that would have to be resolved in any kind of normalization of relations. Another question comes, We've got hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese living in this country, many of which would like to go home to their country, many of which served with Vietnamese veterans in the Arvin Army over there. And will these individuals be able to go back with full rights? There's just an awful lot of questions, and I don't think the Clinton administration is addressing those. They talk about, you know, that they're doing their best effort to account for the POW MIAs. I don't agree with that, but even assuming they were, you've still got all of these other collateral issues that I think Vietnam veterans, since we're the ones that suffered the most and sacrificed the most of this war, have a right to insist. I mean, for example, we're talking about the end of World War II and the 400,000 or 500,000 Americans that died in that war. Well, some of the things that were accomplished out of that war was our enemies are now our allies and are very democratic countries and are very capitalist countries and are very oriented toward us. I'm not saying Vietnam's going to be turned in that because it's a different kind of country. But by the same token, I certainly think that we ought to have some say-so. We certainly did in Korea. When we kept the Korean Republic free from communist aggression after a very bitter war there, the government in Korea today, while it's not a model democracy, is far, far closer to our ideal of democracy and freedom than what they have in Vietnam or Laos. So these are some issues that we're going to be watching real close, and I just think that the veterans on Capitol Hill, the Vietnam veterans especially, are going to be real leery about the Clinton administration wanting to go in there and help out their big corporation sponsors to go in there and normalize relations with Vietnam without coming up and addressing all these collateral issues. It's a much more complicated subject, and the POW-MIA issue is the lightning rod on all this, but there's a lot of other things under the surface there that I think are going to our organization will insist be addressed, really.
The thing I'd like to say, too, is we don't hold any animosity toward the Vietnamese people. It may sound that way, saying you're listening to it. It is not aimed towards them. If there is any animosity felt, it's towards our own government.
For the falseness.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about POWs and MIAs, a new postage stamp just came out a few weeks ago on Memorial Day, which pays tribute to prisoners of war and those listed as missing in action. What do you guys think of the stamp, Paul?
Well, I think it's a wonderful opportunity for not only healing, but showing the members, the family members of the POW-MIAs that we have and continue standing committed against not only normalization of relations with Southeast Asia, but for a full accounting. And as we know, there's 23 still listed as POW-MIA from the state of Arkansas. With the recent return of two sets of remains, our national organization has initiated over the past year what they call the Veterans Initiative. That's where we have sidestepped not only our government, but the Vietnamese veterans in which we fought against have basically sidestepped their governments, and we're working veteran with veteran to resolve these issues and these cases. And the only it's just a solidarity and a show of commitment with the stamp, and it's a welcome opportunity. We started in 1989 in Fort Smith, Arkansas, under the direction of John Thompson and Waldo Fisher. And it's just been a long, worthy battle, and we've finally gotten the stamp. So we're hoping that it's definitely a healing process. And this stamp, I want to say something and clarify something right off. This stamp is not just for Vietnam POW-MIAs. There, in fact, over all the years that we've had since World War II, there's been 98,000 POW-MIAs still unaccounted for. So this stands for all, each and every family member. And this stamp was a direct result of Tim Hutchison, congressional leadership, our representative from Northwest Arkansas, that went out in Washington and got 83 congressional endorsees on this stamp. And it's direct result of our show of commitment and his commitment as well as basically standing on no normalization, no further normalization of relations with Southeast Asia.
So what are the issues that are of importance these days to Vietnam veterans?
I'm going to turn that over to Mr. Stanley, our legal counsel, and I think he can probably be pretty exact on most of those.
Well, one of the issues, I guess, and it'll probably never go away, is the continuing exacerbation and reoccurrence of Vietnam and the re-debate of Vietnam. And I think former Defense Secretary McNamara's book has again brought this to a head. This is one of the things that we as an organization, and on behalf of our members and other Vietnam veterans, we're going to have to continue to deal with for the rest of our lives, essentially. Vietnam will continue to be debated, redebated. I think it will also, there'll be further discussions on this subject as we move toward whatever type of normalization we have with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, I think is what they refer to it as. And as a result, when these kind of things happen, the fall of Saigon was 20 years ago. McNamara's book came out. Budget funds for the Department of Veterans Affairs are proposed by the Republicans to be significantly reduced. Fighting for the POW-MIA stamp. Ongoing finding of remains in Vietnam. All of these things continuing to put salt in the wounds of Vietnam veterans. And I don't think it probably will ever end, but we're going to have to deal with it as part of our healing process. That is one of the ongoing issues that's really kind of a theme to being a Vietnam veteran and for our organization. And we've made a commitment, just like it, in our motto, so to speak, is never again will one generation of veterans abandon another generation of veterans. And we're committed to helping these veterans out dealing with these problems. What are some of the other problems we're facing? Well, one of the biggest ones, obviously, is the budget. Because everybody up on Capitol Hill, with a few exceptions, wants to chop the federal budget. And the Department of Veterans Affairs is no exception. And the proposal that we have seen, and again, it's only a proposal, would result in the loss of up to 9,500 physicians, nurses, and other health care personnel in the VA system. It would result in an increase in the delay of processing of claims for various benefits. It would result in perhaps as many as 100,000 veterans, maybe even more, not receiving benefits at all, particularly health care benefits. It would result in further delays in research and treatment. And those kind of things are simply not acceptable. I don't think there's a veteran around that's not willing to do his or her part in helping get the federal budget under some kind of reasonable control. I think we all realize that that's a serious problem, but you should not try and, quote, balance the budget on the back of veterans. That's not fair. Veterans' benefits have long been recognized to be something that this country owes. It's not an entitlement in the same sense like welfare or AFDC or something like that. It's a benefit that has been awarded to a veteran or a veteran's family because of their sacrifice, of their commitment. And I think our country would be doing a great disservice to veterans if this budget comes to pass in any shape or form like it's being proposed right now. And I will assure you that every veterans organization that I am aware of or familiar with the VVA probably right at the front of the leadership on this, will vigorously oppose legislation to significantly reduce the funding for the Department of Veterans Affairs. Indeed, this budget doesn't even allow for any increase in the cost of living, which I think is unacceptable also, because they're giving it to Medicare and Medicaid. So this is a real certain. This is a concern that affects flesh and blood members. This is not something hypothetical. This actually affects human beings, some of our friends, our comrades.
And not only that, Michael, let me give you a break just a second and bring Wayne in on this. Not only that, it affects the family members. You know, we're talking about veterans. Every veteran has children and they have responsibilities. When it directly affects the veteran, it puts the burden back on the communities and back on the family members, and this is definitely not fair. We're charging inconsistencies and unfair and unjust treatment back on the families that are trying to encourage and support the veterans to maintain a stable job, maintain a stable relationship in their communities. And Wayne here, for one, has worked a good number of years on the homeless veterans problem. We've got veterans dying in the streets of this country, and we continue seeing the doors in the VA system being closed. And, Wayne, you want to bring them up to speed on what we've done for homeless veterans?
Well, we tried to establish a homeless center here. Supposedly they have money to do so through the VA system here, although that is yet to come about. And it looks like it probably isn't in reality not that. But one of the biggest problems among veterans, and probably the fastest growing veterans, and not at least as far as the homeless, is not the Vietnam veterans, the Desert Storm veterans. These are people now who are at the age where they're having problems. There's been a lot come out about Desert Storm Syndrome or whatever you want to call it. All these problems are being brought up, too, is if they downsize or cut back in the budget of the Veterans Administration, it leaves another generation of veterans without their problems being addressed and creating a whole another effect to generation of veterans that could be crippled.
Now, Gulf War Syndrome reminds me a lot of the problem with Agent Orange, and it took the U.S. government, 20 years or so, to admit that there was a problem with that.
We fought for legislation to get passed for 13 years. It was finally passed in 1989, and it's an unfrivolous attempt to appease us as veterans and, again, our family members of buying us off. So Jim can elaborate on that. He fights this battle on a daily basis.
Well, one of the reasons why we have legislation now in place that would provide for compensation for the Gulf War Syndrome, as it's often been euphemistically referred to, is because the Vietnam veterans, especially the 44 members that are in Congress that were Vietnam veterans, basically said never again will this type of experience occur. And indeed, I just read the other day that much of what they're now finding apparently is traceable to the veterans inhaling and ingesting the carbon fumes from the burning oil fields. That appears to be one source, and there probably will be others found down there. But we do not want to see the Gulf War veterans go through the same kind of problems that the Vietnam veterans did to fight for compensation, both in the courts and the Department of Veterans Affairs, for, as Paul said, 20-some years. And even now, the compensation is less than adequate. The settlement compensation has been cut off now for further applications, and the amount they paid was a rather trivial amount at any rate. And as far as compensation through the VA system for Agent Orange compensation, it's still a tough nut to crack, because basically most veterans that do receive compensation for Agent Orange benefits have diseases that nobody on God's green earth would want, because most of them are terminal. And those veterans that have lesser diseases, for the most part, are having their claims denied. Now, that doesn't mean they may not prevail on appeal, but the problem is still there. It's just, you know, you don't want to sound like crybabies, and we're not, but it just seems like one impediment after another is over the years has been placed in our footsteps. Post-traumatic stress, Agent Orange, seeking redress in the courts, trying to obtain and finally obtaining a right to take the VA to court. Through an appellate court. The veterans' battles never end when they leave the battlefield. They continue when they get home. And I think this is what we've taught our brothers from the Persian Gulf and Lebanon and Grenada and Panama and whatnot, that they too are going to have to be vigilant, both to fight for the rights and benefits they're entitled to, and then at the same time protect those they've got. You know, that's an ongoing problem. There's concern now that they may take away compensation for veterans that are less than 30% disabled. And they've talked about wanting to tax veterans' benefits and talk about taking away cost of living adjustments. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are on the table. Many of them for the first time that they were never even seriously debated for a long time because it was just assumed they were off limits. But now Congress, or at least many members in Congress, I should say, have said that these veterans' benefits are fair game. And so we've got some real tough battles ahead of us on the Hill. We really do.
Jim, one of the things you had mentioned was the book that's been released by Robert McNamara, which, of course, has been a real source of controversy since that first came out. You say you're about two-thirds of the way through it. So what do you think of it?
Well, it's called In Retrospect, and it's kind of a soul-searching rendition by Robert McNamara of his 7 years as the Secretary of the Department of Defense, and in particular his conclusion and the reasons for his conclusion that our experience in Vietnam was wrong. Wrong militarily, wrong economically, wrong politically, wrong socially. And he readily, in the book, identifies, as you go through the chapters, and the chapters are by dates. It covers a period of time. And during that particular era, like from this month in 68 to this month in 68, he covers the decisions that were made. He then analyzes those decisions as to their rightness or wrongness from his perspective, and then tries to bring it into context with what we have learned since then. And to his credit, I will say that McNamara holds no punches back. And when he feels an official, including himself, deserves to be criticized, he rarely admits it. I think that the common theme I've been able to glean out of the book so far, and the two-thirds I've gotten through it, is that, A, they didn't have enough information. North Vietnam knew a lot more about our country than we knew about them. And same way about South Vietnam. We knew very little about it. We had very few experts. Secondly, the other thing, and it would almost be comical except for all the tragedy that occurred, is that these highly educated, highly intelligent, supposedly, individuals sit around and talk to the president. I'm talking about people like Omar Bradley and Dwight Eisenhower and Walt Rothschild and Dean Rusk and McNamara and Wheeler, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and, of course, Westmoreland. And they cannot come up with any good solution. Any option they have come up with is an option that, at best, is a poor option or no option at all, whether it's neutralization of the country or withdrawal or graduated response or full military intervention or some other option. And in the final analysis, nobody seems to be able to make a decision. I guess comparing that to the decisiveness, for instance, that Truman took at the time of the invasion of Korea, where he decided on a limited war, but a war that would preclude North Korea from subjugating South Korea, and or when Bush went into the Persian Gulf and followed the UN resolutions and said, we're going to do this, we're going to get them out of Kuwait, but we have no intention of invading and occupying Iraq. And whether or not all those decisions were necessarily correct, you know, that's debatable, but at least there was a defined mission and they knew what their goals were. Not so with Vietnam. And that probably is one of the tragedies, and I hope, and I know there's a lot of controversy over the book. I'm glad I'm reading it, and I'm glad I have read it. That, because I think if nothing else is learned from that book, is that never again should the United States become involved in a conflict, whether it's a minor one or major one, such as Bosnia right now, or Somalia, without having a defined set of goals as to what we can realistically achieve, what we should achieve, and make a decision early on, can we achieve it? Do we have the American public behind it? If we can achieve it, don't get in the first place, and if we do get in, follow it through to completion. And none of that was done. And I some of the documents that McNamara has referred to, the Pentagon Papers and other papers and the meetings he's had, the councils he's had, you just see time and again that neither Johnson or anyone else in his administration, and Kennedy for that matter of fact, were able to come up and make a final definitive conclusion as to what needed to be done. Should we resume bombing? Should we have a pause? Should we open negotiations? Should we close off negotiations? Should we increase troop strength? Should we go from guarding security-type force to actual active ground combat? Should we go into Cambodia? It's just, you know, these debates go back and forth. And if it was in an academic environment, that'd be fine. But you're dealing with human lives and money. And that was the common tragedy of this whole thing. And this book brings that out. If nothing else, that simply because you have highly educated people with incredible amounts of intelligence that was furnished by the CIA that told them how many folks they were sending down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and how many supplies were going in, they couldn't come up with any decisions. They couldn't come up with any final conclusions. They'd talk about this and that, and it was just a real lack of leadership is what it amounted to at all levels, and that's what failed us. And of course, the end result is it costed the Vietnam veterans 60,000 lives, not to mention all the families that were destroyed or hurt. Not to mention the divisiveness in our country, which still goes on today. And so that's probably the theme that's going to come out of this book is not so much that McNamara's admitting he made mistakes. I think everybody knew that before he wrote the book. But the fact that he and so many others had a real crisis in leadership. And if nothing else, that's a lesson I think that definitely is learned from Vietnam.
Well, looking back at Vietnam and the problems facing veterans is obviously something more complex than can fully be addressed in a half-hour show. But in conclusion, what are the next steps? What do Vietnam veterans plan to do next in trying to address the problems that veterans are still experiencing today?
I'll tell you what, we've pretty much stuck on the same agenda over the last 10 years. A constant reminder for those veterans and family members to encourage veterans to get into the VA hospitals, apply for Agent Orange compensation, for being tested. These are things that we need the numbers to maintain. We can give a number to the Department of Veterans Affairs. These are things that we want to encourage veterans not to turn their backs on the VA hospitals. The more participation we get, numbers come in strength, and this is going to help, and we want to encourage membership within our organization. We don't have the clubs. We don't have the fancy buildings. We are hard-hitting facts. We stand on facts. We stand on truth, and we don't mind going up against any administration. We have year after year, either at the state or the congressional level. So our agenda is definitely going to be for a full accounting for the missing in action, for Agent Orange resolution and compensation, for judicial review, for against the downsizing within the VA. And like Jim clearly said a while ago, we thought there was a possibility that the new Republican regime would go to Washington and be our salvation, but we're not seeing that. So our agenda is going to be on fair and just treatment.
I think that you're going to see for the next 10 years, and this is something our organization would like to see, the Vietnam veteran and the Vietnam era veterans to really become in their own. And one area we've already seen, and that is in the leadership in our armed forces. One of the reasons that Desert Shield and Desert Storm were so successful was because, unlike previous wars, the political establishment recognized the need for a decisive, quick, successful military conclusion to this conflict, and they allowed the leadership of the military forces, who learned and got their teeth cut in Vietnam, to assume a leadership role, and did a very, very, very good job. So our armed forces over the next 5 years will be headed primarily by the Vietnam-era generation veterans. And that's one of the areas you're going to see a lot of leadership on. An area I would like to see leadership on is more and more Vietnam veterans, going into Congress. Right now, the number of veterans in Congress has gone down. The last Congress, we had 44. I don't think it's that many this time. There are the Vietnam veterans in Senate and House. I would like to see more, to assume leadership roles. Same way in our gubernatorial offices and whatnot. And so, I would hope to see more in our corporate leaderships. I think now, you know, the World War II veterans, you know, pretty well were the ones that took the leadership role of the Cold War era, if that's what you want to call it, the periods of peace and of prosperity and the Watergate era and whatnot. And they were the leadership role when we had Vietnam. McNamara was a World War II veteran, for example. Johnson was. Kennedy was. Dean Rusk was, the leaders you had during that time, Richard Nixon was. Now we're going to be assuming this leadership role, and the country's going to be looking to our generation in the political, the military, the economic, the international relations, and that's where we're really going to have our opportunity to shine. And I hope we will, and I think we will. I think that Vietnam has taught us an awful lot of things and probably gives us a much different perspective than the World War II era veteran that grew up in the Depression and fought a different kind of war. And so I think that, you know, if we get all our ducks in order, I think we can really give this country some leadership that is badly needed.
If anyone wants to get in touch with you guys, what's the phone number?
That'd be 376-2119. That would be a Monday through Friday, an 8-to-5 number. That we do have an established office, but right now the best way to get a hold of our organization is at the 376-2119 number, and we can encourage and lead whatever crisis or whatever's going on in a veteran or a family member or somebody that wants a direct question to an answer that sometimes they don't get through the VA system.
Okay, 376-2119. Paul Howell, Jim Stanley, Wayne Knowles, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to Newsroom, a production of the Radio TV Film Department of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. We welcome your comments and opinions. Write to Newsroom, KUARKLRA, 2801 South University, Little Rock, Arkansas, 72204. I'm Michael Hiplin. Thanks for listening.